You have to wait.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Okay, yeah. I feel very, very honored there, particularly because I come to this whole audio business sort of from left field. As you heard, my background is really in microwave engineering and non-acoustics, but audio has always been a lifelong hobby for me, and the strongest parallel between those two fields is the approximate equivalence of wavelengths. Like I always tell people, there are 20 gigahertz signal, which I'm had to deal with quite a bit, is about the same wavelength as a 20 kilohertz audio signal. So when I looked at loudspeakers and what we did at HP, where we did as a hobby, we built loudspeakers, amplifiers, and all these kinds of things. For our own use, we looked at loudspeakers as antennas. And so a loudspeaker to us was an antenna that went from 20 megahertz to 20 gigahertz. And when you look at it as an electrical engineer, you say, wow, that's a very wide frequency range.
Excuse me,
you know,
I'm just, it's crackling on your mic.
No, these connectors are just terrible connectors, by the way. Look at it as a microwave engineer. No, no, it's an absolute chunky connector. And so when you look at loudspeaker as an antenna, you also look at the radiation pattern of these things. And unfortunately, that is something that the audio industry, I think, has overlooked for the longest time, that the important thing is that the loudspeaker produces a certain radiation pattern. And it is important because our hearing deals with radiation into spaces, reflections, and as our hearing has evolved over a very long time and knows quite well how to deal with that situation. So I picked this pretty curious title here for my talk, The Magic in Two-Channel Sound Reproduction. Why is it so rarely heard? You would think that two-channel sound reproduction has been around for a long time. Stereo has been a long time. 50 years ago, when I got interested in this here, we built loudspeakers. We still built them pretty much the same way. And in retrospect, I would have to say we still, on the majority, do the same screwy things that we did at that time. So the individual transducers, the tweeters, the woofers, and those components, those elements have greatly improved over the time. But the application is not that great. And hopefully I can spread the word here and give a little bit of education of what to do for designing loudspeakers. And I must say I'm talking about loudspeakers in domestic spaces, because you here are involved in loudspeakers for large spaces, PA systems, so there the situation is somewhat different. But I'm talking about sound reproduction in acoustically small rooms. So there's a number of topics I will address. First is our hearing under anechoic conditions, and to see what's important there. Then we talk about the room response, what the room does to our hearing and how we deal with it. Then the typical stereo reproduction based on the typical stereo loudspeaker put in a room, and how the two work together. Then what I consider optimal stereo reproduction, what gives you the magic that few have heard, and that seems probably like a little bit of an arrogant statement, but I can tell you in my experience, even with professional people in the recording and audiophile business, I have observed people have not heard it. And then finally, I will talk about specifically two loudspeaker design examples of loudspeakers that fulfill these requirements that are needed. And lastly, I will put out a challenge to loudspeakers designers in general. And I don't know how many of you are actually designing loudspeakers here in this group. Yeah, there are a few hands there. Okay. All right, so let's get going right away with the hearing under anechoic conditions. And let me get my laser pointer. Here under A, oops, can you see that pointer? Probably not.
Yes. Yes.
Under A, we have a human head with some headphones on it. And let's assume we are playing a mono signal, same signal, left and right ears. And what we hear is some auditory scene that happens right between the speakers inside the head, right? Smack inside the head. Particularly if the signals are identical, it's right in the middle of the head there. If you increase the level of one signal, say on this ear here, the image moves over to that side, but that's about it. Nothing goes outside. And that is because the brain, which has to interpret the sound streams at the ears, doesn't have any further cues than having identical signals, identical signals there. What's missing is that if I change my direction of looking or change my head, normally these signals at the ears would change, but with headphones on it, they don't change there. So that's the first problem, and that's a really big problem. It's hearing has the same unconscious or preconscious operation in it like the eyes have. The eyes are never resting fully. We're always moving our eyes, and you're not even aware of it. You're always scanning. So the picture on the retina is always changing. That's where you get your three-dimensional impression. It's not just a static that you have two eyes. So it's not just a static that you have two ears, which gives you the full spatial information. So it's not surprising then when you take a head tracker that is mounted to the headphones and changes the ear signals as you turn your head, that even a monaural signal that is normally smack inside your head, once you move it and the ear signals change accordingly, this signal can go clear across the room at any distance pretty much that you want it to be projected. So that I have experienced that personally. It's quite dramatic. And furthermore, what's even more dramatic is that once you have this brain sense that there is this movement and that now the signal is out, say, across the room there, when the head tracker is turned off, the signal still stays across the room. To me, that was absolutely astounding. And so when I moved my head a few times, it still stayed there. But when I did it again, and a third time, then all of a sudden, this monaural sound source from across the room kept sliding towards me, like, and smack was right between the ears inside my head again. The lesson of that is, my brain, I had learned that the signal was out there, this pattern was stored in the brain, and it took several new inputs, you know, to override this and to learn that no, the cues are no longer correct, the signals are the same at the ear, so the signal cannot come from out there, it comes directly from the speakers. Okay, so that's something about hearing under any conditions with headphones. And these days there are great attempts made to use this headphone reproduction, building HRTFs into the signals of left and right ears there to get directional properties to the signals. And they work to some extent, but even when you get the HRTS by using dummy head recordings, my experience is that the image is always spatially distorted. It's way too close to your head. So it works wonderfully if you want someone to whisper into your ears, but it's not so good if you want to have a person speaking way in the back. You know? There's a great amount of spatial distortion. But like I said, with head tracking, things can be done very, very realistic. Now, let's go to loudspeakers. And let's assume we have the situation here where we have a listener, two loudspeakers in an anechoic room, and the listener's head is blocked, so he cannot move this head. There's a curtain in front of the two left and right loudspeakers, so he doesn't see them. And we play dual mono signals through the loudspeakers. He hears an image right inside his head. Same like with headphones. When he's allowed to move his head, to turn his head, then all of a sudden he will hear a phantom image smack between the loudspeakers. When he is allowed to move a little bit, move over to the side, that image will move over to that side. But if you move it just a little bit sideways, you have a little bit sideways. If you listen to noise, you hear a comb filtering effect, which, by the way, has been called the fundamental flaw of stereo by Floyd Toole, and I don't quite agree with him on that point. Because it certainly is there, it certainly is audible, and particularly it's audible on test signals, because what's a poor brain going to do? You know, it doesn't know anything about pink noise or those types of test signals. But the moment you play music, we have pattern recognition coming into place, and this effect is much, much less pronounced. And the point here is that as you move further, the signal clearly comes from, say, from that loudspeaker there. What's happening here is that by nature, our hearing is programmed to always find the real source of sound. It's very important. It's a survival mechanism. It's a mechanism that takes place automatically all the time. And so the direction from where an unfamiliar sound comes, or even a familiar sound comes, the distance and the properties of that sound source is very important to know. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have that, right? You know that the ears have no flaps. We have no ear flaps. We have eyelids and they have no earlids. They are always open. They are always at work to work. And a lot of this hearing happens pre-consciously, before you even are aware of what's going on. Now let's add reflections to the whole picture. And here I have the example of a listener, a room, two loudspeakers. The left loudspeaker has a different radiation pattern than the right loudspeakers, because I wanted to make a point there. The left loudspeaker has a radiation pattern, a polar pattern, like a closed box, which means it radiates only at low frequencies. The colors don't come out here really well. It should be red. The green is, as frequency goes up, it becomes more and more forward directional. And then at high frequencies, only forward directional radiation. It's like these speakers that you have here. You know, they all have the same basic characteristics. On the right here, we have a dipole, figure of eight radiation, and if done properly, it has that polar pattern at all frequencies. And what happens is that as the signals coming from the speaker, say from the left speakers, gets reflected at the ball, the signal that is reflected is colored compared to the direct signal, because in a different direction there is a different polar response. Now, the brain or hearing mechanism works on the principle of sound stream analysis. So we listen both to the direct stream from the loudspeaker and also from the streams coming off different angles as reflections. And we have the ability to segregate between the different sound streams, all done preconsciously. You know, it's not that you say, okay, now I'm going to listen to the reflection from there or from there, but the brain is able to sort out what is coming from the room and what is coming directly from the speaker. When you do recordings, I'm sure you have had the experience that when you play back a recording, that you hear all of a sudden in the recording all sorts of things that you were not aware of when you were in the real life situation. That there were some hum in the room there, or saw a lot of reverberation that you didn't hear, because the ear brain system blanked it out. So it's part of natural hearing. In this case, in the case of the dipole or of the speaker of constant directivity, the reflections have all the same timbre, same spectral content. It's sort of a neutral system, and it's for the brain a lot easier to not mix up the reflections of the room with those coming from the speakers. This situation is very much like the cocktail party effect, where you can have a conversation with one person directly in front of you, and while there are many conversations going on, and you can tune about, move them beyond the acoustic horizon. But if you want to tune in, you can, even while we are talking here, you can all of a sudden follow the sound stream that's going on over here and listen to that. Okay. It's an ability of our hearing mechanism. You can hear it or suppress it. Okay, now, the reflections is a matter of life when you put loudspeakers in a room. Here's an example of a dipole loudspeaker. This one here, and I used the mirrors basically to create this picture. So you have this loudspeaker, but you have not just this one, you have seven more speakers as reflections in the wall. There's a floor reflection, the speaker, there's the floor reflections, the side wall reflections, rear plus side, rear plus four. Here you put some carpeting in here that maybe attenuates some of the floor reflections. But it's a messy situation, and the brain has to deal with it, and it does. It does quite effectively, because, again, for survival reasons, we always have to deal with signals in reflective environments. Here's an example of one dipole speaker, in a room corner. This is actually my living room. The time scale is 50 milliseconds across. Here's a direct signal. It's a 220 hertz burst signal, 1.25 millisecond burst. Here's the first strong reflections that we have. And these are all the various reflections coming from wherever, floor, ceiling, back wall, other side wall. And but you see how they decay when I put sort of this dashed line over it. I get a decay in the order of 40.8 dB in 252 milliseconds. A picture that shows this even more clearly is when I... Okay. Is the crackling really annoying? Or
yes. Yes, it is.
Is it? Mm-hmm. I guess I don't hear it here. I hear myself.
Is that all right, Chan?
Thank you.
All right. So, on this time scale, we're talking about 250 milliseconds between these two burst signals. And you can see for the first, here's the first reflection, and then it decays there, and we get a decay rate from the slope here of 319 milliseconds in 60 dB. Okay, you can derive that from that there. But the point of this whole thing is that there's a lot of reflective stuff going on there. And when you look at some of the research that's been done, there's Schroeder in Germany, they have this big chamber with an acoustic, with a dome of loudspeakers and an echoic chamber. And the name of the author, Peter Damaski, has written a little booklet, Acoustics and Hearing, which I highly recommend. It's a bit of expensive. I think it's $80 for 100 pages, but it has really good information on it. And they investigated how the reflections pull the direction of a signal over to the side. And what they observe and what they plot there is that the reflected signal has to be stronger than the direct signal before a pull in direction occurs. It's different from the work that Freud Toole has done there, where he looks basically at the threshold of detection of reflections, which that's much lower, but that's a different effect. So when the reflection occurs early, it has to be really strong to be effective and recognized. And then again, from a survival mechanism, it would make a lot of sense. If I hear a signal coming from there and a reflection pretty soon, I don't want to be distracted by the reflection. I want to stay focused on the direct signal. If the reflection comes late, like after 50 milliseconds or so, then that may not be actually a reflection, but it could be a new signal. And so there the threshold is much, much lower, or the signal can be much lower and still has to draw your attention to it, right? Because this may be yet another source that I should pay attention to. So all these things are going on totally preconsciously. Yeah. Now, in the room response, one other thing we have to consider is that, particularly in small rooms, which are small meaning small compared to the wavelengths that's being radiated, that if you have a source here, a wall behind it, and a wall on this end, the signal that gets radiated gets reflected from the other wall, and you set up a standing wave. And as a listener, if you're against the wall, you get a maximum. And in this case here, we have a 50 hertz signal, 6.88 meter long room. And the different places you could sit, and you get different response, not what people want to have. And if you look at the source as either an ohmic, a dipole, or cardioid, they all will set up this standing wave, except they will do it with different magnitude. The coupling of the mode, the coupling of the speaker to the room is varies, you know, with the kind of radiation pattern that the speaker has. But fundamentally, there is no difference there. But the important thing is really the transmission from the source to the listener. Not just the mode by itself or all the multitude of modes that are possible, but the transmission, the transfer function. Now, what I recommend and what will be important for what I call the optimum system is that the wall behind the speakers here is diffusive, not absorbing energy. You don't want to lose energy. But the wall on this end should be either non-existent, should be open, you don't want to set up a standing wave, but a traveling wave, so that the signal sort of comes from here, goes past the listener, and you don't have this particular situation. Room acoustics, I'm sure you're well aware of it. A lot of it can be sort of mathematically calculated, but not all of it is really that useful, particularly in small rooms, because rarely are rooms just pure rectangles that one can easily calculate. Here's an example of this room that has a length of 6.88 meter, a height of 2.75 meter, and a room volume of 92 cubic meters. And it's an acceptable room, and according to Robert Walker, who I met last night here, from his work at the BBC, you may know this relationship here. The room is acceptable if 1.1 times this ratio of width over height is less than the length over height, is less than 4.5 times width over height minus 4, which in this case here applies. 2 is less than 2.5, is less than 4.0. This little formula developed by the BBC in 1996 here. I was very happy to draw it last night. Okay, what's very important in for rooms is the room absorption, and before I talk about that, we can also calculate how many modes are possible in the room below a certain frequency. And in this example, if we pick 150 hertz, the total number of modes that is possible is 55 modes. Doesn't mean that they all are excited or exist, but that's what's possible. The average mode spacing at 150 hertz is 1.6 hertz. So they're very close together in frequency. Eventually, they will, as you go up in frequency, they will overlap in frequency. At that point, we talk about the reverberant sound. The other parameter that is important is the wall absorption. And if we take, for example, assume an absorption for this room of 25%, which means that 25% of the room surfaces, ceiling, walls, floor, act like open windows. 25%, that's a large percentage. Then you would get a reverberation time of 456 milliseconds. If we could increase this number to 50%, so half the surface area is absorptive, perfectly absorptive, then you get to 200 to 228 milliseconds. You have the that's pretty difficult to do. So you really need to have additional means like bulk absorbers and various other things to get to that level of reverberation time. And in domestic rooms, you usually don't get there. Recording studios or so do this. In my opinion, it's not a very pleasant environment to live in, but it's a work environment where it seems to be needed. Now, as part of the reverberation time, we can estimate the resonance bandwidth. The bandwidth of these modes here is 4.8 hertz for reverberation time of 456 milliseconds. The modes have a rise time of 146 milliseconds. The Schroeder frequency, this is the region above which you have overlapping modes in frequencies. Below it, you have discrete modes. The further down you go in frequencies, the more widely spaced they are. And in the design of optimal room, people have tried to have the spacing, the separation, frequency separations of rooms, uniform, not clusters of modes. But I don't think that part is really, at least in domestic rooms, is really that significant. What is significant, I think, to recognize is that we have a The reverberation distance or critical distance, this is a distance where the direct sound becomes equal to the reverberant sound. And it always surprises me how small this distance is. For a monopole, for this room example, it's 0.8 meters. In other words, at 0.8 meters from the source, you're already at the same level like the reverberant field in the room. While when you have a dipole, you get a square root of 3 advantage, the distance is 1.39 meters. To get the same 1.39 meters with a monopole, you would have to have reverberation times of about one third of this, so about 150 milliseconds. So that shows you how big of an advantage a dipole has over a monopole in terms of critical distance. Okay. So now let's look at the typical loudspeaker. And like I said earlier, the loudspeaker hasn't much changed in the last 50 years. I would say 90% of all loudspeakers are box loudspeakers in various shapes and sizes. But the basic shape is a box like this, or a little two-way system, or a three-way, four-way system like that. When I got interested first into loudspeakers, the thing that raised our curiosity was the fact that the drivers were not aligned in a vertical line, but there was a tweeter over here, mid-range somewhere there, and then a woofer there. And I remember asking Loy Finchen from KEF, why do you do that? You know, what's the reason behind it? Well, that's the way it sounds best that way. That was the answer, right? And basically, people were playing around with the polar pattern, not knowing, and trying to come up with just by hearing, what combined the outputs from the drivers as optimum as possible. And at that time, people used a big box full of capacitors, inductors, resistors, with big knobs on it. So your crossover, you could just dial in different capacitance values, inductor values, and the company had a pair of golden ears, some guy there, who was the ultimate reference, and he said, yes, this sounds good enough. And that became then the standard that everything was modeled after. That seemed pretty unsatisfactory to us as engineers, you know, particularly if you were designing antennas or throw microwave antennas, you would never do something like this. And actually, it was interesting. Loy Finchen and a group of engineers came over to California with a group of his lab engineers, because KEF had bought one of the first Fourier analyzer that Hewlett Packard had brought out. At that time was a big rack full of equipment, computers and stuff. The disk drive, big disk drive, this memory drives there, and stuff you have today practically on your telephone, you know, that kind of stuff. And they got trained on it, and to me this was a wonderful opportunity to have a person there to ask questions. Why do you do these things, you know? What's going on? And I remember I couldn't meet with Laurie directly at the time there because I was busy on business. And so I wrote him a letter. And again, at that time, no email. This was an airmail letter. It was the fastest way to communicate between California and England. So I wrote down all the questions that we had. Loudspeakers were, to us, the sort of the mysterious part. We were well familiar with power amplifiers, stereo decoders, and all this type of stuff, but loudspeakers seemed mysterious. So I wrote down all the questions we had, and he wrote back a nice piece of stationery. I hadn't written the whole thing. And basically he said, it's very curious that you have all these questions. We have very similar So all of the developed correspondence I still have today, it's about two folders, this thick, you know, of paper that went back and forth, and a friendship, and I often stopped by in England here when I was on business and stopped by Jeff. And Laurie Finchon actually later came over to California, and he actually lives right now very close to where we live. And he is with THX now. He's not designing loudspeakers, but he's right now the latest sickness he is into power amplifiers. Very, very low distortion power amplifiers. So, anyways, I want to point out that not much progress has been made as far as I'm concerned. And loudspeakers, you still see that practically all loudspeakers have a bend of some sort to get more low frequency output, to get use a resonance, basically store energy in the speaker so the bass is not short and dry, but the boom, you know, it has some hang on. You get a big peak and group delay with something like this here. There you have a tiny little tweeter that has to cover the high frequencies. The shape of the cabinet often is made narrower here for wider dispersion at high frequencies. The problem of spurious radiation from the walls, some people solve with building cabinets out of aluminum, machine them out of solid aluminum pretty much, or putting heavy bracing inside. Because it's a real problem. When you measure the sound pressures on the inside of a cabinet like this, they are enormous, very high SPL levels. And these pressures, of course, push on the walls. The walls, particularly when they're flat walls, they have resonance modes, and they re-radiate the sound there at particular frequencies, and usually in a nasty frequency range in the few hundred hertz range. And so these speakers, all these box-type speakers, have what I would call a generic sound. It is so generic that you already know when you walk into a store to listen to different speakers, you already know what to expect. Because fundamentally there is not much difference between the speakers. And the cabinet contributes a lot to that. Okay, so that's and of course the radiation pattern of these speakers is very generic. Omni at low frequencies, forward radiation at high frequencies. Now some manufacturers actually go a little further than just equalizing for flat on-axis response. They have a design window, say plus minus 45 degree horizontally, plus minus 20 degrees or 15 degrees vertically. But this loudspeaker really radiates all around 4-pi space, you know, front, back, top, down. And that sound is, in a reverberant environment, it's also heard. It's not just the direct sound, but all the sound going into all directions. And so it's important to have control over the sound that goes into all these different directions. So then when we look at what happens when we listen to a pair of these typical loudspeakers, we have on the left-hand side a listener here sitting in the sweep spot. These blue lines represent the room, the loudspeakers. We are clearly aware that we are listening to two loudspeakers. We have an auditory scene that happens between the loudspeakers. It's usually half bounded by a loudspeaker on the left and a loudspeaker on the right. The height of the scene is typically the height of the speaker. So if you have a little pair of speakers, you have a window that's about this high and covers the width there, and it may be very precise inside the window. There is often very little depth to it. And the immediate giveaway is when you move over to the side, like here on this side, this listener, that the whole thing, the whole scene, the auditory scene, collapses pretty much into the nearest speakers. It moves very little. And the reason for that, again, is natural hearing. We, by nature, do not like phantom images. It's dangerous to listen to it. It's like a Fata Morgana, right? You need to identify always the real source of sound there. It's important for survival. And if the speakers are highly directional, it's like listening to headphones at a distance, but it still has this effect that if you move out of this sweet spot, things collapse into the nearest speaker. Now, as opposed to that, is what I would call the optimal stereo reproduction, and this is the one that I describe as one adding magic to the whole thing. Is in that case, you have a scene that is not hard bounded by the speakers. As a matter of fact, the speakers disappear. You see them, but they are seemingly disassociated from what's happening. And the scene is not just the height of the speakers, but it's higher, it has more height, has depth. It's really 3D, which is quite astounding. And when you move over to the side, it's not collapsing into the nearest speaker, but it's changing the viewpoint. It's just shifting, like watching the orchestra sort of from an angle. It's still spread between the speakers over there, and not collapse into one speaker. It's an effect that I often have people come to my house and they sit down and they play something, and within 30 seconds, either a big smile goes on their face or they start laughing, which I find a curious reaction, you know, that people start laughing. It's immediately recognized when you hear it. It's hard to describe in words, you know, from what you hear, but it's possible to do. And in order to do this, you have to have five requirements. The speaker's 4-pi power response has to be similar to the on-axis response. That means the off-axis response has to mimic the direct on-axis response. It can be lower in amplitude, but the timbre should be the same. In other words, the speaker should be neutral. Okay. The speaker should be free of audible non-linear linear distortion. That's sort of an obvious thing, you know, when the voice call is rapping or if you have too much stored energy from a vented speaker that gives it away as a speaker, draws attention to it, then that's clearly not nice. But the other requirement is that the speaker has to be set up at least 1 meter from large reflecting surfaces. And that requirement comes from the fact that our hearing mechanism is then able to differentiate the direct sound coming from the speakers, the direct sound streams, from the streams coming from the room, and puts them over the acoustic horizon so we are not aware of it. That kind of phenomenon, I think, is happening all the time. When you walk into a room, like when you walked into this room here, and you heard some noise, you already preconsciously did an analysis, sort of an analysis of what sounds would sound like in this room. So if a new sound arises, you know already how to associate what is reflection, what is contributed by the room, and what is that I need to pay attention to. And the other point here is the space behind the speakers should be diffusive, should not be absorptive, even though they are in the recording industry or studio places that are live and dead end, which put the dead end behind the speaker and the live end behind the listener. I say, no, just the other way around. The live end should be behind the speaker, but diffusive, and the dead end behind the listener, traveling waves. And the living space should have a comfortable acoustic behavior. Shouldn't be dead, shouldn't be a reverberant chamber, somewhere in between there, so in the 450, 500 milliseconds reverberation time. So that's what I consider the optimum. And that can be done. And let me show you now two speakers that will accomplish this type of things. Two very different speakers, as a matter of fact. Here you see a dipole speaker, a full-range dipole, has two 10-inch drivers at the bottom, an 8-inch lower mid-range, 3-inch upper mid-range, 1-inch tweeter, and there's actually a 1-inch tweeter also on the back side to get the dipole action at high frequencies. And I'll show you next speaker from the back. The speaker from the back side, you'll see this. So this is a 4-inch dipole. This speaker is sort of a hybrid, a real strange thing, you might say. It's an upward-firing 5-inch driver. This is a pipe, actually a piece of sewer pipe. I went through the hardware store to see what I could use there. This is, in the U.S., it's called Schedule 40 PVC pipe. And these are all parts of our sewer systems, the end cap. It's a plastic to clay coupler. And on top of this, here sits a 3-inch driver, a 4-inch driver. And we'll show this later in more detail what it is. But let's look first at the dipole driver. Here's the dipole from the back side. You see the woofers driving to the back. And of course, the back side of the driver is on the tweeter on the back side. If we measure the frequency response of the woofer, that's very easy to do with a dipole. We can just put a microphone right in the opening here of this cabinet. That the microphone is so close to the driver that the radiation coming out the front of the box doesn't really affect the measurement here on the back side. And what we see then in such measurement is a response like this, a black curve. Well, the both curves look actually black here. So this curve has a peak. I want to use this driver from 20 hertz to 120 hertz. And we see here is a resonance. This resonance is due to the opening because the wave, as it's launched from the cone, is ducted within the cabinet, and then the cabinet opens up to white space, so there's an impedance mismatch, acoustic impedance mismatch right there. And that causes this resonance here. And here, the lower curve shows this just with a little bit of equalization. So it's easy to get rid of. But there is a lot more equalization necessary because this is just what comes out of the box on one side. If you move away from the box so that the radiation from the other side starts interfering with this one, you get an additional 6 dB per octave slope on this that draws off, that has to be equalized. So we have to first, if I want to go to 20 hertz, equalize this here to flat, and then an additional 6 dB per octave boost, and later I will show you the equalization curve for this device. I don't show any polar pattern because the box is so small compared to the wavelength, there isn't much possible except to generate a dipole radiation pattern. And this dipole radiation pattern even works in a reverberant room there. You can hear it when you walk around with a microphone, not with your two ears because it picks up too much of the reverberant field, but you can walk around it, but if you come into the null plane, you hear this very little coming out there, go around. You can rotate the whole thing. Okay, this is the next driver, the 8-inch driver. This one is used from 120 hertz to 1 kilohertz. This is a fourth order crossover here, second order crossover there, and here it is, shows the dipole behavior. The curves are wiggly. All my measurements I've done outside of my house in the backyard, and it's not much space there, have trees and bushes in there, so I'm pretty familiar with what to look for and can interpret these curves. That's why I don't like to show curves like this. People say, oh yeah, you have all these wiggles in there and it's not flat. No, it's not quite like this. It's just the dipole behavior, 1.3 dB down at 30 degrees, 3 dB at 45, 6 dB at 6 dB, 12 dB at 75. So it follows that quite nicely at these frequencies. Up here, above a kilohertz, things get a bit more erratic. If we go to the next driver, the 3-inch driver, that is used above 1 kilohertz and up to 7.5 kilohertz, yeah, the dipole behavior is not that pretty anymore. And when you look at the barrel shape, to accomplish all this, it's a matter of, let me step back. To accomplish all this, the baffled shape here, this shape, this angular shape, is to get the off-axis response the way I want it. Here for the 3-inch driver, I try to have as minimal baffle as possible. For the tweeter, you would see later there, I have to widen the baffle because there's another tweeter behind it here. And I want to hide this other tweeter from the front, except for off-axis angles. Yeah, the front and rear should interact. So if we go look at the response for the tweeter, you see here. Oops, there's my. You see here, I'm using it above 7.5 kilohertz. Again, it's not exactly dipole, it's actually more beamy than a dipole would be, but still not too bad. Down here, where it would normally fall off at 12 dB per octave, but because front and rear drivers interact, this falls off at 18 dB per octave. And then here's a different region, dipole region. Okay, so that's this speaker, and here's the equalization. The equalization for the woofer, and you can see, a very steep curve here. This is 10 dB scale between the units there. The green curve is to cut off, it's an alternative equalization because some of the recordings have a lot of subsonic material on it. And I tried to equalize down to 5 hertz, carry, not flat to 5 hertz, but carry the roll off as 12 dB per octave down to 5 hertz to have not a huge group delay peak at the low end, which is where group delay is audible. And what that means in an open baffle, a lot of excursion. So the woofer in a dipole is the most critical part in terms of finding a driver that can do it. It needs a huge motor, typically very large excursion capability, to operate with basically garbage in the recording, not to interfere with the actual signal. Yeah. So you can, on some recordings, you see the woofer cars are moving slowly back and forth, and there's no useful material there, but the useful material is riding on top of this, and you don't want that to be distorted too badly. Then the next curve is the lower mid-range, then the upper mid-range, and the tweeter. And lower mid-range and upper mid-range as a more shallow crossover, 12 dB per octave. So they act like one unit. Okay. And now here to this speaker, this is the hybrid thing. the pipe here, the upward firing 5-inch driver, here's a 3-inch driver open in the back, except for this structure behind it. So here you have an omni. This radiates like an omni. And the crossover is about 800 hertz. Still quite low in frequency, but it nicely acts as omni. And here crossing over to a dipole with a first and second order crossover, so a lot of overlap. Now the when you take an omni, combine it with a dipole, in this direction here, the two interact and add, while in the rearwards direction, they subtract from each other. In other words, the combination becomes a cardioid. Okay, but only in the transition region. And then above the transition region, this here is the dipole, and this body behind here is acting as a scattering body or diffuser, because I want to be able to have the speaker sitting fairly close to the wall behind it, and I don't like to have specular reflections from the wall behind it. So this is scattering for song. So let me show you some frequency response curves. This is the on-axis response, on-axis of the full range driver. Here the top curve is the on-axis, then the here's the woofer by itself, the tweeter by itself, and the notch here is when I reverse polarity of one of the drivers, indicating how well they are opposite in phase when I reverse a phase, or conversely when I put them in the right phase, how precisely they add to each other. Because the two outputs from the woofer and full range should be exactly in phase. Okay, so you have about a 20 dB null there. So this is on axis. This is off axis in the front. Down here, again, ignore this all this wiggly stuff. The scale here is 5 dB between the major lines. Here it's essentially omni, and then it spreads out, becomes more directional as we go up. The green or yellow line here is 45 degrees, plus minus 45 degrees. And this, by the way, applies for this speaker both horizontally, vertically, at that angle, any angle. It's like a flashlight, okay? It has that behavior all around. It's an acoustically small source. And this goes from 0 to 75 degrees. I didn't plot the 90 degree on this one here. So this is in the front. And if you continue turning this thing, going to the rear, again, at low frequencies, it's omni. The green is the 45 or 135 degree line. And here you see the null, which is a cardioid region. That's exactly at 180 degrees, is this line. At 180 degrees, at this measurement distance that shows, this actually comes up. There's a bright spot right behind the scattering body. That's something typical also in optics, you know, that you have behind the shadowing body. You can have a bright spot at the right distance here. But basically, this here is a mess in terms of radiation pattern above the speed, which is what I want to have, right? Okay. And here's the equalization. It's just a woofer to equalize, and the tweeter, and it looks a little bit funny because the tweeter is in breakup mode, so the equalization is a little strange. All this is done for both speakers. I do the equalization these days. I do it with the digital signal processing. Could be done in analog. In the past, I've always used analog filters, but these days it gets difficult for do-it-yourself us to get the components, to get the precision capacitors, and particular capacitors. For something like this, equalization like this can be done in analog, but it's so easy to do in digital. It's almost trivial to do these things with a DSP unit. I can provide just the fire to someone by this DSP unit, hold the fire, and you're home free. So that's really attractive. Okay, and both of these speakers, the dipole and this hybrid speaker, are capable of the magic, what they call the magic in stereo. And to repeat again, the power response is very important. The off-axis response has to simulate the on-axis response. Low distortion of the speakers have to be able to play at significant volume levels. The difference between those two speakers that I described, they're timbrally, or when you listen to them, you say they sound the same, which is also a very interesting thing. They sound the same, timbrally and everything. The only difference is that the little speaker at the low end, it cannot reproduce the bass. It's just physically impossible. Yeah, it's rolled off 3 dB at 45 dB, while the other one goes down to 20 dB. So you have another octave there. Really important octave, by the way. And the speakers have to be set up at some distance from the walls, less so with the little speaker. And the wall behind the speaker is diffusive, absorbed it behind the listener. And again, these are ideal requirements, but you don't have to fulfill them absolutely. And put the speakers in what is called a comfortable listening space, what people have called the fill the room with the stuff of life, you know, what you normally put into your room, what bookshelves and stuff. No special acoustic treatments. And I don't know how many of you are here acousticians, and you make a living by putting the absorbing materials and diffusers or so into the room. I say, no, forget about all this straw out. Put your pictures on there, wall hangings, chairs, furniture. Make it so it's comfortable for you to live in, to have a conversation in the room there. I mean, the speaker shouldn't be anything special in that sense. But the speaker, and that's where I deviate probably from most people, the speaker to me is not a piece of furniture. It's a transducer, electrical in, acoustical out. It's a machine. And so it's also why these curious forms basically say, well, what do I have to do in order to get the acoustic results that I'm after there? And so they have, to me, they have the beauty of their own nature, you know. And furthermore, once you listen to them, you very quickly forget about the speakers. That's the whole point, you know. You're not listening to the speakers, you're listening to the music. And I have taken both of these speakers to many shows or so, and it's always fun for me to watch people getting involved with the music. They came to hear the speaker, but then they listen to the music, you know. They tap along or so, or forget about the speaker, and then they come back because they want to listen to more stuff, to more music. Yeah. So that's a very satisfying experience. Okay. So my challenge to high-end speaker designers, and don't know how, well, there are maybe just a few here, but it's, I think it really is applies in sort of my mission that I want to get out is just please recognize that the listening room is rarely the problem, but it is the loudspeaker. How it illuminates the room, that's what the problem is. Typically, when people take a speaker home and it doesn't sound as good as in the showroom, they say, oh, my room is not good enough. I have to do something about the room or so. No, it's not the room. It's the speaker you bought. Strong speakers. The flat frequency response on access frequency response is not a sufficient description. It's sort of a necessary description, but not sufficient. Certainly not sufficient. Reduce the variation in speaker directivity. Same thing is saying keep the power response. Well, the power response is actually a misnomer. We don't listen to power, we listen to sound pressure. But people like to use the term power response. But basically meaning keep the off-axis response similar to the on-axis response. reduce nonlinear and linear distortion at high SPLs. That's sort of an obvious thing. And lastly here, I had this idea. I think that every respectable speaker designer should build himself one of these hybrid speakers to have a reference of what I would call sort of the bottom line for high-end audio speakers. You know, that's sort of I'm setting a bar there that you should at least achieve or exceed of. Not that this speaker is the ultimate loudspeaker, but don't call anything high-end if it doesn't do at least as well as that speaker. And by the way, it's very easy to build yourself, so a reviewer hopefully could build it themselves. Material cost is something like including DSP and power amplifiers and drivers and plumbing stuff is something like $1,000 to $1,200 for a pair of these speakers, including power amplifiers. So it's not that expensive, this speaker, really. And it's fun to build. And it's funky. And younger people, when they see it, they say, oh, that's cool. Okay, so that's basically what I have to say. And I ask you to please spread the message. Constant directivity. Proper setup. And you will enjoy stereo like you have never done before. Because I have played around with surround systems. I've had surround speakers there. And first listening, they're impressive, but after a while, there's something about it that is just a little bit tiring. These are totally untiring. That's another giveaway. Tiring always means to me the brain is working in the background to correct for something that it has to work on. You build a speaker that is friendly to the brain, that is friendly to the built-in DSP unit, you know, DSP, ASP unit, it's probably ASP unit between the brain. That's also why when it comes to room correction, I'm not so much for room correction. Sure, you can achieve any sound you want using room correction, but your brain is enormously capable of dealing with various acoustic environments. It had to. You just need to give the brain the right cues. And in all my experiences with speaker design, it always came down to avoiding the cues that mislead you from believing there is an illusion created. Because what you hear with a pair of stereo loudspeakers, it's just a total illusion. It's just happening between the ears in your brain. There's no sound coming directly from between the speakers if you hear soloists singing there. No, it is just happening in your head. It's not there. But the illusion can be so good that I often call it, it's like a magic act, a stage act, you know, where somebody pulls a rabbit out of the hat there. Or cuts a woman in half, and you know your brain says it's not happening, that's not true, but it's done so well that you fall for the illusions, and you enjoy falling for the illusion. So, thank you. Well, it gets very reflected, you know.
But it's not the same as direct sound coming from, like, your dipole version, where everything's coming towards you, so...
No, the dipole is also... The dipole is... It's not coming to... The dipole is a balloon. It's like a tennis ball or something like this, the way a dipole radiates. not just in the horizontal plane, but also in the vertical plane.
But the higher frequencies that are coming from the woofer, because it's carrying a relatively wide range, are there any frequencies there that are more less omnidirectional towards the top end of the range there?
At 120 hertz?
Oh, it's crossing over 120.
120 hertz. Now, I try to keep everything in the region where the things are acoustically small, where the combination between them is still acoustically small. The whole speaker is acoustically small, but in the case of the dipole, they are vertically aligned. You know, there's acoustically small sources vertically aligned. So it's interesting when I run a burst signal that covers the whole frequency. A sequence of bursts that cover the frequency range, right? You know, but bursts that come, makes the sounds, yeah. when you sit in the sweet spot, you actually hear the bursts going sort of from below, sort of forming a line. You know, I use this as a test for imaging, you know, for processing. And it's interesting that if your ears are not quite right, one of my ears is not as strong as the other one. It's a high frequencies. So for me, it goes... Okay, if I turn around like this, it goes... I can tell it's the ears, it's not the speakers, you know.
I have a question. You had said the front wall behind the speakers should be diffusing. Diffusive. What about flush mounting the speakers in the front wall? Would that be an alternative tactic?
Flush mounting is an interesting thing. I can only say from experience. To me, a flush mounted speaker always sounds the speakers off the wall. And I don't quite know what it is in our head that allows me to say, well, the sound is just coming off the wall. I never had a really satisfying experience from a soffit mounted loudspeaker. Yeah.
Right.
Somehow we recognize that the speaker is in the wall.
So you good?
Can you speak a bit about the way the dipolar system interacts with the room modes? Because I know you've written extensively about this area, but you didn't touch on it really today. You know, the modulation transfer function with a dipolar system is so much more tight. You know, it's much more, it's a flatter modulation transfer function than monopolar.
I guess you're referring to the low frequency part.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't mention that. The bass performance, the problem with room modes that you have not with these little speakers here, but with a typical stereo speaker. For some reason, you don't have that with the dipole. And I've been curious, why is that? And so I tried various ways to analyze and find out what's going on here. To measure it, the easiest way to find the difference between a monopole woofer and a quartz woofer and a dipole woofer is to measure the modulation transfer function. In other words, take a low frequency tone, and I usually use say 50 hertz and modulate it at 5 hertz, or 60 hertz and modulate it at 6 hertz. In other words, the sidebands are always 10% higher than the carrier signal. So you get a modulated, fully amplitude modulated signal. And when you play that to your system and walk around in the room, you can hear, you don't need even a microphone or something, you just walk around the room and you see how much of this is very low frequency modulation can you hear. I call it articulation. And in some cases, the articulation completely disappears, like a 50 hertz tone all of a sudden becomes purely 50 hertz, no modulation on it, Other places there is a very high modulation on it, more than 5 hertz modulation, 10 hertz modulation on it. But this is all due to the reflections from the room. And when you do this between for monopole woofer, it has a lot more variation in this modulation than for a dipole woofer. Is this what you were referring to? And the explanation that I give, but I'm not 100% sure, is that the dipole excites fewer room modes, but that is not totally satisfactory, because you would say if you excite fewer room modes, you should have more variations in the phase distribution in the room. But that's just the way it is, and it works just uncannily if you use a dipole woofer. That I have had this experience now in so many places, rooms of various sizes, at shows, most recently in a recording studio where there was a very expensive, very large playback system set up in a recording mixing studio. And I brought in one of them and we measured the whole frequency response. It was very up and down there. We put in a pair of dipoles and very nice and smooth response. So the interaction with the room is different there. And the closest explanation is the modulation transfer function. I mean, it's a measurement, but exactly why is a modulation transfer function so much better?
So does that result in a improved image at low frequencies?
Yeah, it definitely improves the image. It sounds like the bass that I hear in the concert hall. I love to go to the symphony hall and listen to the symphony. That's sort of my reference for recalibration of hearing, because when you design a speaker, it's very easy to fall into a trap that you absolutely love what you do. So I try to stay honest and recalibrate myself very regularly. And actually, I used to do a lot of clandestine recordings. So I could come home and put it in and hear. And I had written notes during the performance and to see, do I hear the same thing when I play back? And now I don't do it anymore, because I feel I'm really there. But particularly the bass section, when it taps a bit. The drum just slightly, you know, there's a certain character to the sound that I get very, very nicely with dipoles. But you also get the slam, but that requires really good drivers for the bass and a lot of power in the power amplifiers driving it.
Sorry, just a comment on the low frequency thing. In Boric's first edition of the Loudspeaker and Headphone Handbook,
yes,
there was an article by, I can't remember his name, he unfortunately died young, but he actually had to go with dipoles, and one of his arguments was if you take all the reflections and extending the images up to infinities, if you were doing them in modes, they tend to cancel each other out.
If you think of
the image model of speakers next to a boundary, and you just extend the room to infinity in all directions, then they effectively cancel each other out. Whereas monopoles reinforce.
They reinforce. Yes.
Yes, and that was his sort of.
Yeah, there is not the there's other people call it room gain that you have with a monopole that you don't have with a dipole.
Yeah. Yeah. That might be a reason.
It could be that. Yeah.
Was it Glenn Adams?
Glenn Adams, that's it. I knew it was Glenn something, I couldn't remember the second name. But they took it out of the later editions, which was dreadful.
The other thing that is important at the low end is not to have a banded system, but a sealed box system, if you use a box system, a monopole system. Because the vented system has, because of the resonance system, you have a big group delay peak, and that group delay peak is audible. It changes the bass character. And surprisingly, not the very low end of the bass, but higher on up in the bass, it seems to be where the character changes. And so like I said, it's to me, it's comparing to live sounds, acoustic sounds, yeah, not to other loudspeakers. I don't really listen to other loudspeakers as a comparison.
Just one little question about if a dipole loudspeaker has the ability to stimulate your brain the right way, so you actually enhance the way you can listen to things, can a dipole loudspeaker be better than the real thing? can you, in a given room which is not really good acoustically, can you actually listen to something in a more favorable way through a loudspeaker than the actual real thing?
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that. I've had people come and say, this sounds better to me than the real thing. Yeah. But that depends very much on the recording, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. The recording, in my book, the recording is still the ultimate, the weakest room.
Let's assume it's a closed mic recording. Let's assume it's an unequivocal recording.
Well, then it sounds like an anechoic recording, and it sounds far worse than anechoically.
Okay, but you're playing back in the room, so you will actually hear the acoustics of that
room. No, when you play it in the room, that's the whole point about this thing. The room doesn't contribute to your perception, but you hear what was on the recording. So if the recording was done outdoors or anechoically, it will sound like it was done outdoors or anechoically. If it was done too closely mic'd, it would sound very closely mic'd. If it was done in a concert hall, and I have my arguments with a recording engineer, a producer from the San Francisco Symphony, wanted him to change his microphone setup to a saw because I don't think he's doing, to my sense, the optimal job there in terms of spatial capturing. Then that will also show up. Yeah. The recording is still the weakest part, I think. But that is not to say that you cannot enjoy something else. You know, it's just I personally just like to hear music in a context, because all sounds exist in a spatial context, and I don't want to lose it. Now, the philosophy that Jack has, or Symphony, has, we record, or he records, by the score. That's what the conductor wants to hear. You know, he sits there with the score, and the microphone setups are done in such a way that he wants to, they want to hear what supposedly the composer had in mind, right? Whatever. We don't know either, but Fitzy Thomas thinks it's the composer had in mind. That's how I record. And when I said to him, but I want to like to have a recording that sounds like when I sit in the best seat in the house. And his answer was, we don't record that way. If you want to hear it that way, buy a ticket.
Siegfried, when you do the equalization on these systems to bring up the low frequencies,
yes.
Do you worry specifically about the phase of those filters, or do you just let the phase take care of itself?
Oh, no, I very much worry about the phase, yes. It's not just amplitude, it's also phase, yeah, very much so.
So what you end up with is something that is essentially phase linear?
Oh, you mean the overall phase?
Yeah.
No, the overall phase is the overall, it's not a minimum phase system, the end result is not a minimum phase.
No, it can't be.
Transducer, yeah. And I don't really worry about it. I have talked to a number of people who have put work into it. and take the response, say, like what I've done, and then do, again, you can do it with DSP, put the linearizing filter on it that just linearizes the phase, because what I come up with is a non-minimum phase system, all gas type response. And they say, yes, there is a difference on test signals. Test signals, instead of sounding click, it sounds clack. But once you put program material in there, then it becomes very difficult to differentiate. Plus, in the program material, there is so much distortion already, the phase distortion in the program material, that I wouldn't expect that you can really hear much. But that's what I heard from people that have done it. But again, the phase response, or the, really not the phase, but the group delay at the low end of the frequency range, that does matter. That's why it's important to carry the low frequency and at least keep the phase under control as far down as possible, or to keep the group delay from having big peaks there. That's a very low end.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
When I was researching your citation, I spent a lot of time looking at your website, and I was intrigued by these loudspeakers, these weird loudspeakers that you built. And you know, you've done us the proud to present those today. You know, now, so my question is about the first one with that unusually sculpted baffle.
Yes,
and it's all to do with the radiation pattern.
Yes.
How much of that was done purely empirically with 1,000 different shapes and 10,000 different measurements, or how much was done theoretically to develop that shape?
It was done empirically, but not with 1,000 measurements. It was inspired by what's done by in microwave antennas. where your ground planes, where you advertise by putting zigzag patterns on it, and that's for the 8-inch driver.
Yeah.
The 3-inch driver, there I just needed to get minimum size baffle. Yeah. There the baffle is just small enough to hold the driver in place. That's basically all it is, you know. I can't make it any smaller, so I have to live with that. And then in the tweeter range, I haven't found a tweeter that I'm happy with that radiates both front and back. So if I want to get a dipole action, I ended up using two tweeters, one in front and one in the back. And I have to make sure that they interact in a desirable way to get me the dipole effect, not with the right frequency range.
But I would have thought with the tweeter, the acoustic path lengths of the baffles, yeah, etc., would mean that your true dipole, your null that the dipole has, would be very narrow, and it's more just getting a constant radiation pattern rather, yeah, than a true cancelled dipole.
Well, they still cancel now at 90 degrees where the baffle is a thin baffle.
Yeah, it would be very narrow null.
It's a very narrow null. Yeah. And also the other thing is, I really worry only about the radiation in the forward direction, because in the rear direction, the basket of the driver screws up the revised radiation pattern. But I don't care. I say that the same energy that comes out the front also goes out the back. It's not lost anywhere. There's no lossy elements, just reactive elements there. So it radiates in different directions, but I don't want to lose the sound. It will come back to me via the reverberant field in the room. But the exact specifics, I don't care as much.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Steve.
Okay, thank you.
make a short announcement that just before the next session starts, which is due to start at 11 o'clock, I'm going to observe the 2-minute silence at 11 o'clock for remembrance.
Look, I've only got about 2 minutes.
Right, Jamie.
Yes, hello. We have met a couple of times before. If I'll try and... I'm pretty sure our library's got a copy of the first edition of the handbook. And if I can photocopy, I can photocopy it, scan it, and send it.
I have the book.
What, the Boric thing? With Glyn Adams, the first edition. Yeah. But I think, thinking about it, if you think of taking a room with a dipole and just replicating it infinitely in three dimensions and all around, including images, then they're on average going to cancel. Putting the phase in.
It makes sense.
Whereas if you do it with a monopole, of course, they're going to reinforce and cancel much more in a much more extreme manner. I would think that would be the sort of reason you get the difference between the dipole and the monopole.
Yeah.
I mean, that's effectively what Glyn Adams concluded in that. I mean, he had a go, what was it, in the early 70s, so he didn't have the computing power to calculate it, with some rough sums. And it seemed to make sense to me. I could see that, sort of picture that happening. And one can, these days, one could actually probably set the computer up and put a little bit of loss into your walls. Actually, if you're an American house which is of wood construction, it's got a reasonable absorption.
Yeah, it is quite a bit of loss.
Whereas in the UK, we've got the reverse problem.
Yeah.
You wouldn't actually have to go that far out before.
But in the American house, you also have the re-radiation of the walls. Certain frequencies.
Oh, because they're vibrating.
They vibrate.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, yes, I hadn't thought of that. That's modal, but mechanical modal.
You can hear it.
Right, yes.
Ringing,
Oh, right, yes, I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
Turn this off. No, that's not turning it off.
This one. This one.